Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to share my podcast with you, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers in Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, about how he led his team through unprecedented times to create, test, and distribute a COVID vaccine all in less than a year.
It becomes a human decision to decide to throw by the window your business strategy and to do what you think is the right thing for the world.
Join me as we uncover innovations in data and analytics, the math, and the ever-important creative spark, the magic. Listen to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If money is a taboo topic and nobody wants to talk about it, how can we be educated on something we're unwilling to talk about?
April is Financial Literacy Month, and Black Tech Green Money is where culture meets capital. Each week, I sit down with Black entrepreneurs and leaders to share their blueprint for building generational wealth through tech, innovation, and ownership.
Once we know more, we can have more. One thing we tell our clients is the more that you learn, the more that you earn, but you have to be willing to learn.
To hear this and more game-changing insight, listen to Black Tech Green Money on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Sam Mullins, and I've got a new podcast coming out called Go Boy, the gritty true story of how one man fought his way out of some of the darkest places imaginable.
Roger Caron was 16 when first convicted.
Has spent 24 of those years in jail.
But when Roger Caron picked up a pen and paper, he went from an ex-con to a literary darling. From Campside Media and iHeart Podcasts, listen to Go Boy on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On March 25th, 1988, outside of the Brookline Housing Project, a drug deal went bad, resulting in the shooting death of a guy named Jimmy Calabera. Soon, a notorious thief and serial informant named Richard Doyle ran into one of the assailants, a guy named Howard Wesley. And after their encounter, Doyle claimed that a guy who lived at the Brookline houses named John Whitfield, also known as Divine G, was one of the shooters. And while Harold Wesley admitted his own involvement, he vehemently denied Divine's. But Wesley died in jail before getting to say so at Divine's trial. This is Wrongful Conviction. You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. All right. Welcome to a very special edition of Wrongful Conviction. And I say that in all sincerity. We have not one, but two of my personal heroes here today. Jeffrey Deskovic, who's been on the show before as an exoneree. Now he's back as the attorney for a man who's yet to be exonerated, but is as innocent as could be and will be exonerated with your expert help. Is that fair to say, Jeff?
Fair to say.
Jeff Deskovic, welcome back to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you very much. And I do want to share that I do represent Divine also in collaboration with Oscar Michelin.
And it's ironic that his other lawyer is named Oscar, because Divine was just nominated for an Oscar for his film Sing Sing. So he's got Oscar covered in every direction. Were you actually nominated for an Oscar, or the film was nominated?
No, I was nominated for adapted screenplay.
Oh, wow.
That's why I went to the Oscars. You can't go to the Oscars unless you nominate it specifically. Yeah, I sat next to Ralph Fiennes during the class photo.
It's incredible. I mean, this man is just different. 25 years in prison, Oscar-nominated, accomplished author, playwright. I mean, he's a healer, right? I mean, this is a guy who brought peace to a place that desperately needed it through creativity. Divine is out shopping number of new screenplays that he's written. All of us are looking forward to seeing where you go next, because the sky is truly the limit. Sorry if I'm embarrassing you right now, but Divine, I'm just really honored that you're here on our show.
I'm honored to be here, man. Thank you for inviting me.
And this is a New York story. You were born in New York, right? Like me.
Absolutely. East New York is where I actually was born and had lived in Canarsie and Brownsville. I'm a Brooklynite, 100%.
And you grew up in a time when New York, especially in those areas, was experiencing a lot of turmoil. But you somehow or other, even back then, were
working on developing your artistic side, right? Can you tell us a little bit about growing up and your teenage years and what that was all like before everything went off the rails?
I was kind of like a good kid. I was one of them adventurous kids. I was all into really positive and productive things. And I was around about 11, 12 years old. I was so fascinated with Bruce Lee. I used to make 8mm karate movies, me and my friend Frank Johnson. We used to make these karate movies and charge our friends like a quarter, a dollar. That was an early state of my artistic energy. And then I eventually started dancing. I became a really efficient dancer. And I was recruited by a dance group called Realism. And it was a semi-professional group. I appeared on television with Stephanie Mills. Y'all probably may remember this show called Soap Factory Disco in 1979. It was an old show. I appeared on 2 episodes with Stephanie Mills when she was singing her song, Put Your Body in It. I did shows with Anita Ward, Instant Funk, and a variety of other popular groups. And I was pretty good at dancing. Then at that time, I also became a DJ and eventually became probably one of Brookline's most famous DJs. It was a group I had called Mix Machine. Actually, in the movie Sing Sing, they mention it. Coleman Domingo says, yeah, they used to call me Mix Machine, and they mentioned that name several times. And because of the dancing, eventually I went to high school performing arts. And for those who know high school performing arts, that's the Fame School, the famous Fame School.
From the movie Fame.
Yeah, from the movie Fame. They filmed it in that particular school where I was at. I really wanted to go there for acting, so I got in with dance, and I wanted to switch over to acting. But eventually, I left high school performing arts. I just couldn't deal with all of the teasing, the bullying, and I wasn't the type of person who really respond well to abuse. I mean, I knew martial arts, so I got into a lot of conflict. So eventually, I moved on and went to Canarsie High School, where I ultimately graduated. While all that was going on, I always kept an after-school job, worked on the weekends, because as a DJ, I needed money to buy the records, to buy the equipment, to keep things updated. That was basically my life. Before my life, like you said, went off the rails, and then I got into this accident. It was severe. Woke up in a hospital. It was really damaged pretty bad. I couldn't work. And eventually, I even tried to go back to work. I started delivering pizzas. I was a Domino's pizza delivery boy. And eventually I had to quit that job because of the injuries. It was so much on me, and the doctors telling me you can't work. My lawyer telling me you can't work. You got to let these injuries heal. Time go by. I couldn't get unemployment. I couldn't get certain monies. And then I made probably the biggest mistake of my life. All my friends was in the game, hustling out the street, and I was always able to avoid it. But after that accident, I said, you know what, I'm going to sneak out, sell some drugs. And it backfired on me. I didn't last 2 weeks on the streets because I had no idea what I was doing. I had, you know, copped out to the drug possession. I went upstate for 1 to 3. And out of the clear blue sky, they brought me back down to Rikers Island and recharged me for a homicide. A homicide I had absolutely nothing to do with.
It was about 2 months before Divine began his 1 to 3 year bid for possession that this homicide had occurred on March 25th, 1988, somewhere along the stretch of 108th Street that ran through the Brookline Projects. And much of what we know comes from a recorded statement with one of the assailants, a guy named Harold Wesley.
From what I understand, it was a drug deal gone bad. It was between Shateek Harold Wesley, an individual named Patrick, and this guy named Jim, Harold Wesley calls him Jim Carabella. But his actual name, according to the police reports, was Rudolph Migliorisi. What happened is he owed Shateek drugs or something, and Shateek wanted the drugs or the money, and they started arguing over it. And Shateek says that he pulls the gun, shoots him in the head, and then he made Patrick stand there and pull the trigger. Then they run, and Harold Wesley says that he sees a woman who was dressed in some sort of green coat or something. That was Marjorie Shack, whom he said she lived in that building on the 3rd floor.
Divine only found out about this recording and Marjorie Shack long after he had been convicted.
Come to find out, we eventually tracked her down, and Marjorie Shack also confirms that she told the police it wasn't me. The police kept showing her pictures of me, trying to convince her that it was me. And she said, no, it's not him. It's not him. The night that it happened, I was across town at my stepfather's house over there on Buffalo Avenue. And that night, I remember coming in, and because the crime happened in the back of my building, I seen all the police ropes and police cars in back of my building. So obviously, I knew something happened. Next day, I'm hearing rumors in the neighborhood. Yo, some guys from out of the neighborhood shot some guy in the back of the building.
So the neighborhood was buzzing, but it doesn't appear that anyone cooperated until Harold Wesley had a run-in with police that June.
Harold Wesley had got arrested for possession of drugs, a shotgun, and weed. And when the police pulled him over, he was about to have a shootout with the police. Somehow the shootout was avoided. Harold Wesley goes in custody. Now he wants to cut a deal with the feds. So now ATF steps in, and this is how the audio tape came about. He's on this audio tape trying to cut this deal with the feds. And now this guy starts talking about it. Every crime and everything he knew in the neighborhood. And he's jumping all over the place, too. He's not focusing on one thing. He's talking about this thing, then he jumps to this, then he jumps from here, and he's jumping from there. And it's kind of discombobulated when you read the tape. And on side one of the tape, he mentions me. He's mentioned me about a conflict with drugs that happened with some guy named R and JR, and that he was trying to get me to pay him to deal with JR and R. So somehow the police thought that he was saying that the JR and the R was Jim Carabella. So they got that whole thing all screwed up. So by the time you get to side two of the tape, you can see that they're confused. See, the police already knew that it was Shatik and Patrick that did it. So they confirmed that. But then he said, well, then what about Divine? Well, did Divine order it? And then Harold Wesley cleared it up conclusively by the end of the tape. He said, no, Divine didn't order it. Even he was getting frustrated with ATF agent. His name is Bob Hamilton. He was getting really frustrated with him. Like, well, why you keep bringing up this Divine character when I'm talking about something else?
And while this recording happened and Wesley was in custody, a guy named Richard Doyle and his friend Scott Bell were arrested for burglarizing the home of someone named Marsigliano, as well as for possession of crack. And Doyle knew Divine from the projects, but they never got along. So that's a bit of bad luck when Doyle ran into Harold Wesley.
Richard Doyle saw Harold Wesley Shatik in the bullpens, and because they knew each other, they started talking. Now, I guess what Shatik must have told them, yo, they must have think this is Divine, because you can see on the tape that they actually kept pressing Harold. It kept mentioning my name, and Harold kept telling him, no, not Divine, not Divine. Then Richard Doyle came to Scott Bellew and said, yo, listen, I got a way for us to get out. We can say we saw Divine did this crime.
Richard Doyle got the idea that he was going to get both of them out of jail by falsely implicating Divine for a homicide.
Because Richard Doyle is a professional informant. He's been doing this for a while. He testified in Pencilman Jeffrey's case. He testified in Gary Reedy's case. He testified in multiple cases. So he has a history of this. And he knows that if you come up with this type of information, the prosecutors love you for this and you can get out of jail. So Scott Bellew says, no, I'm not doing that. No, I'm not doing that. So Richard Doyle goes on about his business, and Scott Bellew sees him talking to a man in a suit. And the next thing you know, they walking out of prison. Then after Richard Doyle gets out, a week later, miraculously, he goes to the police station claiming to be an eyewitness to this.
So on the strength of this serial informant's word, Divine was transferred from upstate to Rikers to face this homicide charge, even though Harold Wesley had already cleared his name.
The minute I went on Rikers Island, like about 3 days later, he committed suicide in Brooklyn House of Detention. Well, they say he committed suicide. I did a FOIA request and got all of the documents. They said that they found him with the rope that allegedly hung him under his mattress. So in essence, he hung himself, took the rope off his neck, and put it under his mattress.
Yeah.
So you figure that out.
But like I said, he didn't even know about Harold Wesley or this confession tape until after his conviction, let alone what he was about to face at trial.
I didn't know who actually was accusing me of it until the day of trial. It was a tactic that they used called trial by ambush. They would hide all of the evidence from you. And then on the day of trial, they come in there with a 2-foot stack of documents and say, here. And that's when I discovered that it was this notorious crackhead. I mean, he was the crackhead extraordinaire in Brookline Projects. And he accused me of this homicide.
And here's where discovery laws being inadequate before, which is why we're fighting to try to maintain them now, comes into play. Okay, because this tape that Divine has mentioned, the tape went missing many years later. They claim it was missing. But if it had been automatic discovery right away, very early in the process, then Divine's lawyer could have had that tape. It could have used that at the trial and almost certainly would have gotten an acquittal.
Absolutely.
Discovery laws in New York changed from trial by ambush to automatic discovery in 2020. And right now, various nefarious forces are working to repeal this vital reform. They want to take us back to an era when a request for discovery was both over and underwhelming, as Devine described. A defendant would literally receive a volume of documents that would be near impossible, or impossible even, to digest on the eve of or during trial. But also, the prosecutor would get to decide what was going to be given to the defense, right? I mean, it's the wolf guarding the hen house. And I don't have to tell our audience what a Brady violation is. And in Devine's case, that meant Harold Wesley's confession, any mention of Marjorie Schack, or the deal made with Richard Doyle, who claimed that he'd witnessed Wesley and Devine shoot Migliorese under a street lamp from 35 feet away. And then he'd run to a nearby store to retrieve receipts for some unknown reason and return to the scene with a store clerk named Wayne Harris.
And Wayne Harris says, no, I never saw him that night. But in terms of his credibility here in this case, there's three provable lies. There's another 12 very likely lies.
Doyle testified that his burglary charges had been dismissed before he'd come forward because the burglary victim's nephew, Sal Marsigliano, had directed he and Scott Bell to do it. He also testified that he'd received no benefit for his testimony, even though it was later discovered that the burglary charge was pending through his grand jury testimony, as well as an armed robbery charge in Nassau County that also just poof went away. He also said that after he'd gotten out of jail in June of 88, that he was approached by armed men who he didn't know, implying possible witness tampering. But according to police reports written by the lead detective, Robert Lincoln, he knew who that armed person was and was unrelated to this case. Doyle also claimed to have been sober for months, but on the night he'd been arrested, one of the charges was for possession of crack. In addition to Doyle, the jury heard from the medical examiner about the cause of death, Harold Wesley's arresting officer, about the gun he'd found in Wesley's trunk, and then a ballistic expert linked that gun to bullets recovered from the scene.
The whole case against Devine is based on this one informant. The trial judge, you know, Judge Edgedo at the sentencing even says that.
Right.
This whole case just comes down to Richard Doyle's credibility.
He said without Richard Doyle, there was no case.
And you end up getting sentenced to concurrent terms, right, of 25 years to life, 5 to 15 years, and 2 to a third to 7 years.
I mean, listen, man, it's a nightmare beyond description. You know, when they read it out, you know, the whole courtroom exploded. I exploded. You know, I didn't do it screaming. It was just a nightmare. I couldn't believe it. I mean, my whole family was crying. I was crying. It was just the shock of all shocks.
We ready to fight? I'm ready to fight.
Is that
I thought it was? Oh, this is fighting words. Okay. I'll put the hammer back.
Hi, I'm George M. Johnson, a best-selling author with the second most banned book in America. Now more than ever, we need to use our voices to fight back. And that's what we are doing on Fighting Words. We're not going to let anyone silence us.
That's the reason why they're banning books like yours, George. That's the reason why they're trying to stop the teaching of Black history, queer history, any history that challenges the whitewashed norm.
Or put us in a box.
Black people have never, ever depended on the so-called mainstream to support us. That's why we are great. We are the greatest culture makers in world history.
Listen to Fighting Words on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to share my podcast with you, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers in Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, about how he led his team through unprecedented times to create, test, and distribute a COVID vaccine all in less than a year.
It becomes a human decision to decide to throw by the window your business strategy and to do what you think is the right thing for the world.
Join me as we uncover innovations in data and analytics, the math, and the ever-important creative spark, the magic. Listen to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Camila Ramon, Peloton's first Spanish-speaking cycling and tread instructor. I'm an athlete, entrepreneur, and almost most importantly, a perreo enthusiast.
And I'm Liz Ortiz, former pro soccer player and Olympian, and like, call me a perreo enthusiast.
Come on, who is it?
Our podcast, Hasta Abajo, is where sports, music, and fitness collide. And we cover it all, de arriba hasta abajo. Sit downs with real game changers in the sports world, like Miami Dolphins CMO Priscilla Shumate, who is redefining what it means to be a Latina leader.
It all changed when I had this guy come to me. He said to me, you know, you're not Latina enough.
First of all, what does that mean?
My mouth is wide open. Yeah.
History makers like the Sucar family, who became the first Peruvians to win a Grammy.
It was a very special moment for us. It's been 15 years for me in this career. Finally, things are starting to shift into a different level.
Listen to Hasta Abajo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Novartis, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports Network.
I did time in Clinton, Attica, Green Haven. That was a very racist jail. They got active Klansmen in Green Haven. And I did time in Auburn. I did my rounds, but when I got to Sing Sing, Sing Sing was terrible too, because they had a lot of drug wars, a lot of gang violence, prisons are just violent, period. But when I got to Sing Sing, it was a blessing in disguise, because Sing Sing is close to the city. So they were more acclimated to have programs, and people were more able from the city to come up to the jail. So I seen it as an opportunity. I was on an all-out mission. Being sentenced to 25 years to life can bring something out of you that you don't even know that you got. Waking up every morning into a nightmare. When you go to sleep, you out of the nightmare. You dreaming, you free, and then you wake up. It was like every morning, oh, here go this nightmare again. Here we go again. So that gave me that fire. I got into the NAACP. I eventually went to college. I eventually got a master's degree, started RTA. And
RTA is rehabilitation through
right,
the arts.
RTA is rehabilitation through the arts. You know, it was just a lot going on. And I became a jailhouse lawyer, man, that was very efficient. I learned how to do motions. I learned how to do this, because at that point, I knew that my entire life depended on me finding a way to do it. And I'm not rich. I'm a poor person. My family's poor. We don't have lawyers. We don't have money for that. So I went in that law library and I learned. And ultimately, I do legal writing. I end up becoming a very efficient novelist writer, because I said, once the court start rubber stamping everything, I said, I got to come up with some kind of way to fight this. Well, writing, what can I do? I can write. And ultimately, my memoir, The Whitfield Files, won a national writing award.
It's a Penn Award, right?
Yeah, it was a Penn Award.
In addition to his Oscar nomination, Divine won the prestigious Penn Award four, count them, four times. So we're going to link all of that in the episode description. He was and still is stunningly prolific.
It shocked me at times when I sat back and realized one time I wrote three novels in 1 year. Did a 440, an Article 78, and was running RTA, and was the president of the NAACP, sponsoring culture awareness classes, Black History Month classes, GED classes. People used to ask, how do you do it? And one of the ways I used to do it, I had a meticulous checklist system. Every year, I would write out what I'm going to do for this year. And then every month, I would break them down into months, a checklist in months, and then a checklist in weeks, and a checklist in days. And every day, I would check off those. So every day of my life that was living, breathing, it was about doing something. If there was a moment I wasn't doing something, it was misery. It was like I lived by just staying proactive and moving.
And he brought that drive and organizational prowess to his appellate fight as a pro se litigant, meaning he was on his own without an attorney. And after his initial appeals were denied, his first post-conviction motion, known as a 440 in New York, was based on Doyle's perjured testimony that his burglary charges had been dismissed before he even spoke to police about this, and that he'd received no benefit. But Divine found out that Doyle's charges hadn't been dismissed until after his grand jury testimony. This was a Brady violation as well as false testimony. And in addition, Scott Bell gave an affidavit about Doyle's plan to falsely accuse Divine, who he didn't like, to get their charges dismissed. And there was also an affidavit from the burglary victim, Sal Marsigliano, about how he tried to press charges, but nothing ever materialized. Yet, Somehow, the motion was denied in 1996. So Devine moved on to federal habeas and filed a FOIA request with the Kings County DA, which turned up a disclosure form that mentioned a tape.
When I finally realized that there was a tape, they adamantly insist that there was no tape that exists. I did an Article 78 to try to compel them. Finally, a judge in Kings County said, well, you either have to produce that tape or you're going to have to do a very detailed affidavit explaining why this tape doesn't exist. These documents says that this tape exists. I eventually had to do a motion to have him held in contempt of court. I was doing all of this pro se. And the judge granted it. Then and only then did all of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, the mailman that does the mail officer, comes to my gate with a tape and lays it here and has me sign for it. I'm like, wow. So they did have the tape. They lied to the judge. They kept telling the judge, no tape exists. No tape exists, Your Honor. This is not. And I'm look. And then when I listened to the tape, I said, I see why they hid this tape.
Harold Wesley, when he was being questioned by the ATF, he mentioned that he did the crime with Patrick from Queens. Devine's from Brooklyn. His name's not Patrick.
I couldn't sleep for 3 days after listening to this tape, shocked by the fact that these people had this tape in their possession with this man telling them I wasn't a shooter and I didn't order it. So that's what turns this case into egregious misconduct. You're listening to this tape. This man is exonerating me, and you're hiding it. This is malicious.
So they had that tape, and they had every reason to believe that they should go look for this guy, Patrick, from
Queens. Of course, from the very beginning.
Did they know Patrick's identity, or just Patrick from Queens?
That's all they knew.
That's all we have.
Nobody was able to track him down. I mean, that's the full extent of what we know, Patrick from Queens.
At this point, Devine pursued a successive 440 with Brady material that would have definitely changed the verdict. It should have been a slam dunk, but it was inexplicably denied, as was his amended federal habeas and a slew of successive 440s. But Devine was able to put the demoralizing legal system in the background, not only for himself, but for others as well, when he co-founded what turned out to be the subject of his Oscar-nominated screenplay. And of course, I'm referring to RTA, or Rehabilitation Through the Arts.
One of the things that I vowed, that if I got to stay here in this place, I'm going to find every way in my powers to make sure that any and everybody that I can touch, make sure that they get out and don't come back. I'm going to find a way to strip the system of the thing that they needed most. That was kind of like my fire. Like, if I can help these guys stay out, because guys was coming back. And it was hurting me. It was like, wow, I'm trying so hard to get out of this place. And some of you guys are coming right back. So that was the creation of RTA, finding a way to make sure that when these guys got out, they stayed out.
And our audience will recall hearing about RTA from Jermaine Archer, Eric Glisson, Johnny Hincapier, J.J. Velasquez, J.J., who actually plays himself in the Oscar-nominated film Sing Sing. It's a theater group in the most unlikely place, a maximum security prison, where guys have to do more than just wear a tough face to survive.
I saw the power of art. You got to remember, like I explained to you earlier, I've been an entertainer my whole life, movies, dancing on TV, DJing, the whole work. So arts are what I describe as an explosive expression of humanity. It has this amazing way of allowing people to relax and to be comfortable with each other, to sometimes take the mask off. It wasn't easy now. I don't think it was a walk in the park. But we had a strong steering committee. The founders of this program, we had some good guys, and we were—
Shout them out. Which guys?
My man Dino, Bilal, David Wayne, Pito, Shorty King, Herm. It was just quite a few more. We had a strong network of good, solid people that were well-respected in the system. So when you seen a guy like Dino or Bilal or Shorty King and me up there, they like, wow, these guys was walking the yards of Attica and Clinton, and these guys are stand-up dudes. And it would give other people permission to say, damn, if they can do it, we want to do it. Because subconsciously, a lot of people really want to do like things that's open, and we give them permission to explore. Then in our program, since it's about healing, it's about brotherhood, it's about camaraderie, when you came in, we kind of prepped you that bro, you're going to be dealing with some unfamiliar behavior around here because you're going to have to open up. We're going to have to learn how to work with each other. And once we built it into the program, it just started to blossom and work. And one of the criteria that we always had that was built into the program is that if anybody leaves Sing Sing, go start it up wherever you go. We want to share it with as many people as we can. And we got like 8 different facilities with RTA, and now it's expanded all the way to Ohio and in California based on the movie. So it's expanding. We really would love to have this thing available all across the country if it was up to me.
And what have been the results of this program in terms of violence and recidivism?
Listen, RTA has a recidivism level of 3%. In comparison to 60% of the national average of prisoners who leave and don't get this type of program or this type of involvement, 60% of them come back within 3 years. So I think RTA gave certain segments of society something to live for, because when they wanted to get into RTA, we used to kind of tell them, okay, you got to stay out of trouble for this amount of time. And we would give them an incentive to want to stay out of trouble.
3% recidivism rate, I want to just let that linger for a second.
Yeah. Why do you think I wrote so much? Because every time when I started writing a novel, I was enmeshed in those stories, creating these characters and these worlds and these images. I was escaping. And every time I touched the stage, it was therapeutic. It was cathartic. It was like that moment when I'm becoming the character on stage in that world of the character. I was free. I had to have that freedom, because when we had to go back to our cells, it was like, well, the nightmare begins again. And RTA was that escapism. And the beautiful thing about RTA, we were able to find love amongst so much hate, plain and simple.
We ready to fight? I'm ready to fight.
Is that
I thought it was, oh, this is fighting words. Okay, I put the hammer back.
Hi, I'm George M. Johnson, a best-selling author with the second most banned book in America. Now more than ever, we need to use our voices to fight back. And that's what we are doing on Fighting Words. We're not going to let anyone silence us.
That's the reason why they're banning books like yours, George. That's the reason why they're trying to stop the teaching of Black history, queer history, any history that challenges the whitewashed norm.
Or put us in a box.
Black people have never, ever depended on the so-called mainstream to support us. That's why we are great. We are the greatest culture makers in world history.
Listen to Fighting Words on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to share my podcast with you, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers in Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the CEO of Moderna, Stefan Bancel, about how he led his team through unprecedented times to create, test, and distribute a COVID vaccine all in less than a year.
It becomes a human decision to decide to throw by the window your business strategy and to do what you think is the right thing for the world.
Join me as we uncover innovations in data and analytics, the math, and the ever-important creative spark, the magic. Listen to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Camila Ramon, Peloton's first Spanish-speaking cycling and tread instructor. I'm an athlete, entrepreneur, and almost most importantly, a perreo enthusiast.
And I'm Liz Ortiz, former pro soccer player and Olympian, and like Cami, a perreo enthusiast.
Come on, who is it?
Our podcast, Hasta Abajo, is where sports, music, and fitness collide. And we cover it all, de arriba hasta abajo. Sit-downs with real game changers in the sports world, like Miami Dolphins CMO Priscilla Shumate, who is redefining what it means to be a Latina leader.
It all changed when I had this guy come to me. He said to me, you know, you're not Latina enough.
First of all, what does that
mean? My mouth
mean?
Is wide open. Yeah.
History makers like the Sucar family, who became the first Peruvians to win a Grammy.
It was a very special moment for us. It's been 15 years for me in this career. Finally, things are starting to shift into a different level.
Listen to Hasta Abajo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Novartis, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports Network.
Ultimately, as the movie Sing Sing depicts, I eventually got a clemency hearing from Governor Elliot Spitzer, who was considering me for a full pardon. If you can get a governor to look at this and consider you for a full pardon, it has to be something there.
And according to Devine, the clemency board was confused as to what they were missing about this evidence. Why hadn't an appellate court granted relief? Which, by the way, are great fucking questions, but they let their disbelief and uncertainty lead them to deny clemency for Devine. And so again, Devine went back to the drawing board, hiring an investigator who found out about Richard Doyle's armed robbery charge in Nassau County that was also dismissed around the time of his testimony. So a successive 440 was filed, and you guessed it, that was denied too. At which point, Devine wrote to the newly formed Deskovic Foundation.
Devine had wrote my organization. I mean, people remember me from other episodes, but in brief, I did 16 years in prison myself for murder and rape before DNA exonerated me. And eventually I went to law school and became an attorney, started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. So
with your own money?
With my own money. Yeah. Yes, that's true. So Devine wrote us and we evaluated his case and we determined he was innocent and we saw a potential route to exoneration. But while we were doing investigative work, he had a parole board appearance coming, and it's always our policy to try to get our clients out however it is we can so that they could be free while the long, often uncertain road to exoneration takes place. So we wrote a letter to the parole board, which outlined all the primary and secondary reasons why we believed in Devine's innocence. And as people probably know listening to your podcast, if you maintain your innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility, you're almost always denied parole. So an already unjust prison stay gets extended. But he was paroled.
And that was 2012. So while an attorney with Jeff's foundation, Rita DeVay, hired an investigator and worked on his case, Devine continued some of the work he'd been doing inside as a youth counselor. When his past connection to the art scene in New York afforded him an incredible, almost unreal opportunity.
When I got out of prison, right, in 2012, Lil Wayne's road manager approached me. It's this guy named E.I. Actually, when I was a DJ, I used to look out for him and his little sister, let him come behind the ropes and stuff. And E.I. knew I was innocent, too. Everybody knew I caught a bad deal. So when I got out, he came and picked me up in a Bentley, gave me some money and said, yo, you want to go on my tour with Lil Wayne? I said, you damn right I want to go. He said, listen, I'll let you be a stage manager. If you can get on this tour, it's yours. At first, they wasn't going to let me go. The parole officer said, man, is you crazy? You just got out of prison for murder. You think you going on a tour with a famous rapper? Are you crazy? I said, man, all right, cool. I did an Article 78, filed a major lawsuit. Then I got some media people involved. And I did an emergency court proceeding, which is called an injunction. So they did it like within a week. I was in front of the judge. And I went on that tour, man. It was like the best 7 months of my life, man. And all that came about just because when I was a DJ, when I was young, I had this history of just looking out for people.
And thankfully, Jeff and Rita were looking out for Devine as well. Obviously, Harold Wesley was deceased, but they got in touch with his brother Ralph, who gave an affidavit that his brother told him the same story, that he'd killed Milia Racy with Patrick from Queens. They'd also tracked down the woman in the green coat and Devine's alibi witness, Brian Devery.
So in terms of Devine's innocence, there's a tape we just mentioned. Wesley confessed to his brother. Okay, there's also Devine's alibi. He was with Bryant Devery, Marjorie Shack, who knew Devine from the neighborhood. She said she heard the gunshots and people running, that they passed by her, that it was not Devine. Her story is corroborated by another witness who also didn't see anybody but corroborated the direction that the perpetrators were running from. So we got all this evidence of his innocence juxtaposed with one informant, okay, crackhead, three lies, many other lies, contradicted by witnesses. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
But instead of filing another 440, they applied to the Kings County Conviction Integrity Unit in 2018, who allegedly reinvestigated Devine's case. But by 2023, there was still no relief. And at this point, Oscar Michelin joined the team.
5 years had passed by without the conviction review unit doing anything. So from there, we had a meeting with the then head of the conviction review unit, Charles Linehan, and the line attorney. And Linehan said, look, I haven't read the case, but I took the meeting as a courtesy, but I have the line attorney here. And she was intimating like they just hit brick walls and like she wanted to say, she was on the verge of saying, we're going to close the case. But I'm fast on my feet sometimes. And I saw what she was about to do. And if she had gotten that sentence out politically, it would have been hard for the unit chief to overrule her. So I jumped in and I said, well, what about this witness? What about that witness? Did you talk to this one? Did you talk to that one? No. So I ignore her and say to the unit chief, well, how can you guys be about ready to close this case when there's all these witnesses that you haven't spoken to? Look, can we submit a 12-page report to you outlining all the evidence of Devine's innocence? We'll have complete references to the record, and we'll contrast that with this one informant. So he gave us the okay. And so 60 hours later, you know, a 12-page memo was sent to the conviction review unit. A year goes by, and again, nothing happens. And the next thing we know, we're getting word that he's leaving the unit, going to go into private practice. And we naturally reached out to him again, kind of in desperation, because we really don't know who the new unit chief is going to be. And so we just read the report. And at the end of the day, he did nothing. The most he did was had the case assigned to a different lawyer. The lawyer that had did nothing left the unit. I guess she was never enthusiastic about doing conviction review to begin with. But he assigned it to somebody else, and Oscar emailed him. I piggybacked off of it. I did like a short reiteration of all the evidence of his innocence. I reattached the report, and we heard nothing. And so it's been 2 years. They appear to not be working at all on Devine's case. So our strategy at this point is we're doing as much media as we can. We have a petition for Devine, which calls for the Brooklyn District Attorney to order his conviction review unit just to make a decision. It's been 7 years. Just make a decision. It's been 7 years already now. So people listening would like to sign the petition, spread it around. We certainly need that. The website is freedevineg.org. We're hoping that if we get enough petition signatures, that DA Gonzalez will order the unit to make a decision. We could pull his case from the unit right now if we wanted to and file a post-conviction motion and litigate. That's going to take about 2 years. Okay, and maybe we win. We're supposed to win by everything that's right, but we might not. But we don't want Devine to walk around with this conviction for another 2 years that it's going to take, hence trying to gather petition signatures.
It's freedevineg.org. We'll have it linked in the episode description as well. So sign the petition in the hopes that Kings County will finally do right by Devine. And if not, they'll move on to another 440 to resolve a case for which Devine should have never gone to trial in the first place. Additionally, a case in which the current discovery laws might have given Devine a fighting chance.
When we helped myself and many organizations and advocates, when we helped improve the discovery laws, all the information had to be turned over automatically within the first 2 weeks. And if the prosecutor didn't have everything together in the first 2 weeks, they had another 2 weeks. Anything past a month, they would have to get a court order to extend. Okay, so that's how we improved it.
Laws that are right now under attack.
Well, the District Attorneys Association and a lot of law enforcement, they did a campaign of fear-mongering. All of a sudden now we're not going to be able to solve crimes. People aren't going to want to come forward. Now we're going to have witness intimidation, witnesses being killed, which was all just a bunch of rhetoric because New Jersey, a border state to New York, okay, has had automatic open file discovery for many years. And as I often joke in order to make the policy point, we don't have bodies floating up and down the Hudson River. Okay, so it was all a bunch of fear-mongering. Now, aside from the fear-mongering, the other complaint is they're trying to say that because of the discovery laws, that many cases are being dismissed by judges because the prosecutors are not turning over the information in a timely manner. So first of all, that's not true statistically. And second of all, to the extent that any case gets dismissed, why not get on the prosecutor, meet your deadlines? Right. And so the latest and greatest on that, Governor Hochul now wants to repeal the discovery law. They want to try to modify it. First of all, they want to say that a defense attorney would only have 35 days now to complain that you haven't gotten all the evidence turned over. Right. That makes no sense, because to me, whether it's on day one or day 200, whenever it is that you realize that you haven't been given all the discovery material, you should be able to make a complaint, put that on the record, object, etc. So that's one aspect of it. Second thing is they want to go back to where, instead of turning over everything, they want the prosecutors to look through the file and determine what can be helpful to the defense and turn that over, which is part of the problem before.
The wolf was guarding the hen house.
Exactly right. And that was all under Brady. Now, the second aspect of it is called Rosario material. And in a common sense way of talking about it, the prosecutor would only have to turn over information pertaining to witnesses that they were planning to call at a hearing or at a trial. They would often do that on the eve of a hearing, on the eve of a trial. So not only is there not enough time to read through the material, investigate, interview witnesses, incorporate that into your strategy, but also if they didn't want you to know about a witness, just don't call them at the hearing or the trial and they wouldn't have to turn anything over. So that's the way that it was.
As opposed to a civil case where you have to turn over everything.
Correct.
If you and I have a business dispute, literally you have to turn over everything and all that's at stake is money. And here you're dealing with somebody's freedom, their life.
Right. When I brought a federal civil rights lawsuit in connection with my being wrongfully imprisoned, I had more discovery rights as a plaintiff bringing the lawsuit than what I did when I was a criminal defendant defending myself against the false charges.
Exactly. So we're going to put links in the episode description for people to sign petitions, call the governor.
They can also email their elected officials, the assemblymen, their senators that represent them and say, look, we don't want discovery rollbacks, okay? We want the system to be fair. We want people who are charged to know exactly what the evidence is against them so that they can prepare a defense so that we can reduce the likelihood of wrongful convictions.
Exactly. Because if it could happen to Jeff, if it could happen to Divine, it could happen to you. I mean, that's really the truth. Or somebody you love.
Correct.
So if you do it for no other reason than that, do it. But we should all care about making the system fairer and better for everyone. And now we turn to closing arguments. I'm going to just kick back and not say another word and just listen to anything else you feel is left unsaid. And tradition holds that Jeff, since you're the attorney this time, you go first. And then Divine will take us off into the sunset.
7 years to wait for a conviction review unit to make a decision, are you going to agree to overturn or not, is simply not justice. That's unreasonable. DA Gonzalez, order your conviction review unit to make a decision on Divine Whitfield's case.
I would like to echo that. 7 years is a bit extreme. It doesn't take that much time to just simply make a decision. 7 years, I'm quite sure if you had any intentions of investigating this, you've had sufficient amount of time to do it. I also want to just put great emphasis on the fact that arts is life-saving. Also, I want to remind everyone, the site is freedivineg.org. Please read the evidence of the innocence. Sign the petition and encourage others to sign that petition. It's not a hard task to do. That would be highly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Kleiber. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia.
I'm excited to share my podcast with you, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers in Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, about how he led his team through unprecedented times to create, test, and distribute a COVID vaccine all in less than a year.
It becomes a human decision to decide to throw by the window your business strategy and to do what you think is the right thing for the world.
Join me as we uncover innovations in data and analytics, the math, and the ever-important creative spark, the magic. Listen to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If money is a taboo topic and nobody wants to talk about it, how can we be educated on something we're unwilling to talk about?
April is Financial Literacy Month, and Black Tech Green Money is where culture meets capital. Each week, I sit down with Black entrepreneurs and leaders to share their blueprint for building generational wealth through tech, innovation, and ownership.
Once we know more, we can have more. One thing we tell our clients is the more that you learn, the more that you earn, but you have to be willing to learn.
To hear this and more game-changing insight, listen to Black Tech Green Money on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Sam Mullins, and I've got a new podcast coming out called Go Boy, the gritty true story of how one man fought his way out of some of the darkest places imaginable.
Roger Caron was 16 when first convicted.
Has spent 24 of those years in jail.
But when Roger Caron picked up a pen and paper, he went from an ex-con to a literary darling. From Campside Media and iHeart Podcasts, listen to Go Boy on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.